Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The Alzheimer's Association reports 5.3 million Americans living with Alzheimer's, one of our most feared diseases. As we celebrate the increase in average lifespan, we lament the ways a healthy brain can slip into demise, from stroke to depression to Parkinson's, to simply forgetting why you walked into a room. We scan the research, we crave a cure, but we don't often make the connection between the health of our brain and what we put in our stomach. Dr. Lisa Moscone takes on the standard American diet in her new book. It's called Brain Food, The Surprising Science of Eating for Cognitive Power. She joins us now on the phone from New York City. Dr. Moscone, welcome to In the Moment.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
I will start with a confession, and that is that when I first picked up this book, I had a rather unhealthy snack in front of me, which I thought was no big deal because I was settling down to read and do my research. And really, within the first five pages, I was like, I'm putting that snack away. I don't need that.
Oh.
we don't think about this very much. We think about it sometimes. We think about obesity and we think about heart disease. But
yes.
We don't think about the impact of a poor diet on our brain as much. Why is that?
I completely agree. I think as a society, we're used to the idea that we feed our bodies and that our food choices maybe will change our waistline and perhaps a choice of clothing and that we need to slim down for the summer. But we're less aware that we feed our brains at the same time and that the foods we eat, yes, they do change the way we look, but they also really change the way we think.
Yeah. How new is this research? What are we starting to learn about the impact of a nutritious diet or a poor diet on the brain?
Right. So there's a lot of new research that was made possible by improvements in technology. We now have cheap genomic sequencing, and we have really sophisticated brain imaging techniques like the ones that I use for my research that allow us to really look at the effects of diet directly in the brain, which I feel is something that was missing in all the research. You know, historically, people would look at people's diets and then correlate that with cognitive decline and cognitive impairment or dementia many, many years later. But that was kind of bypassing the brain. So what we're doing right now is to try and correlate your current diet with the health of your brain now. And I think that is really fascinating. We can see how some foods literally change the chemistry inside your brain.
And how immediate, we have so much to talk about. And I'm wondering, let's talk specifically about how long it takes some of these problems to reveal themselves, because you might find somebody who's, you know, sort of slipping into dementia. This isn't something that happened, you know, 2 weeks ago. This is decades in the making. Tell me a little bit about that and how long it takes for some things to reveal themselves.
Yes. So there is evidence that Alzheimer's usually starts in the brain during midlife. Like when people are in their 40s and 50s, the brain starts changing. And the brain is a fighter. The human brain is an incredible organ. It can really withstand damage and disease for many, many years before showing symptoms. And that's what happens in Alzheimer's, that the brain changes precede cognitive symptoms by almost 20 years.
Give me an idea of what research needs to be done still, and what research is sort of happening now that you think is really filling in the gaps of what we don't know?
Well, there's a lot of research that needs to be done. The research that's been done now, it's either focused on pharmaceuticals or on lifestyle for Alzheimer's prevention. And I think what is really fascinating is that we're finally talking about prevention of Alzheimer's. For many, many years, most people understood Alzheimer's as an inevitable outcome of aging, that genes in your DNA or both. But at this point, there is consensus, which is amazing if you're a scientist. Usually scientists don't really agree on anything, but there's consensus that at least one-third of all Alzheimer's cases could be prevented today by improving our lifestyle and really addressing our lifestyle choices and making sure that everybody makes healthier choices in terms of diet, but also in terms of physical activity, intellectual stimulation, prevention of heart disease, management of heart disease and vascular risk. These are all really, really important factors all at once.
How much bad science or junk science is out there, though? Because when any time that somebody, you know, says, here's what's good for you to eat, you know, you could find a whole bunch of stuff that contradicts it online. And how do we sort out the junk from the real science?
Yes, it's such a good point. I was very surprised when I started working in the field of brain nutrition because, I'm a scientist, I'm in a lab, I'm in the clinic, but my patients would really come to me and say, hey, I just read that you shouldn't touch grains anymore, or hey, I just read that I need to eat a lot of fat, or no, actually, now I need to be vegan. And I think I'm a scientist, I've been a scientist for most of my adult life. Science is not fashion. It tends to be treated like fashion. Especially for some reason, especially nutrition and brain nutrition. A few years ago, everybody was vegan, and now everybody's eating a lot of fat. So there's a lot of confusion, and I think there are two major reasons. One reason is that when scientists do work, we usually publish our work in scientific journals that nobody reads. There's an enormous amount of information and literature that is just not available to the public. There are very few studies that ever make it in the news. And then outside of academia, we have internet, and information just travels at a speed that makes it impossible for anybody to actually check the information. And everybody with a Twitter account is an expert in nutrition. It's really interesting, right? Yeah, people treat food like medicine. Like they take sides, they pick enemies, they just very religiously follow one diet or the other diet, sometimes for no particular good reason. Whereas for research, it takes a lot of time, I think, to really come up with a good with a good study. For us, it takes years. I need to find all the patients. I need to scan them. I need to measure them. I need to publish the results. By the time I'm done, most people will have gone through three different diets. So I think what's really important is to look at the literature as a whole, and really, I think more and more scientists should understand that we need to be able to communicate our findings in ways that go above and beyond scientific publications. And for me, it was incredible that I had the opportunity to write this book. I never thought I would be offered such an opportunity, and I thought it was the perfect way to take the research out of the lab and make it really accessible to everybody who might benefit from knowing what scientists think at this point, and what scientists know about brain nutrition.
Well, and it's a very readable book, and as I said, you know, compelling enough to where you'll switch your snack out immediately. I think people who are listening really want some of those tips they can use right now as they, you know, go out and wait to get the book at the library or, you know, visit their bookstore. So let's talk about water first. How important is water for the functionality of the brain?
The brain really is made of water. Over 80% of the human brain is water. And every chemical reaction that takes place inside the brain needs water to occur. And that includes energy production. So water is needed for every single thing that happens inside the brain. That also means the brain is very sensitive to dehydration. And even very minimal loss of water, like a 2% or 3-4% decrease can cause symptoms like brain fog, fatigue, dizziness, confusion, and also brain shrinkage. There's evidence from brain imaging studies that people who are mildly dehydrated show increased brain shrinkage as compared to people who are actually well hydrated. So it's really important that we drink a lot for our brains.
And how much, because when I was reading that chapter, I was thinking about, people in history or people in different communities, even than where I live, don't necessarily have access to all this fresh water that just flows out of my tap. And I have a fancy water bottle that I can just fill up at the drinking fountain with its special spout throughout my working day. So is this something that really impacts different people in different periods of time in different cultures?
Yes. I think humans in general need water to function, but then it depends on where you live. For instance, if you live in a very warm climate, then you need more water. If you are very physically active, you need more water. If you're getting older, as we all do, you need more water. So our brain needs for water actually usually increase as we get older.
Mm. Does our brain tell us when it needs more, or do we just have to sort of measure it and track it and say that that's the appropriate quantity?
I would say 8 glasses of water is a good indication just to start. Okay. And so many people don't drink 8 glasses of water a day. But also there's a little trick that I could share if you want. It's a super quick way to test,
please,
if you're dehydrated or not.
Uh-huh.
So just prepare a bottle with a liter of warm water. So not cold and not hot, just warm. It's important that it's warm. And then just drink very small sips every 5 minutes, just a few sips every 5 minutes, and keep going until you're like halfway through. If after about 30 minutes it feels good and you want more of the warm water, then it means you're dehydrated, and so is your brain.
Interesting. All right, let's talk about food here. What are some of the top foods that we need to look at to maintain our brain health?
I'm going to start with caviar. And I know that it's expensive. I know that it's impractical. But I'm a scientist. I'm a scientist. And the nutritional composition of caviar is actually perfect for the brain. It really mirrors the nutritional composition inside the brain. So caviar would be perfect. I understand it's not practical. So the closest thing we have to that is fatty fish. Fatty fish like salmon, like trout, herring, bluefish, and also sardines and anchovies. And these are not expensive options. You know, sardines, anchovies, they're fairly cheap in any supermarket. These are very, very, very important brain foods. After that, I would say berries. Mm. All sorts of berries are really good for your brain, and most people go for blueberries. I keep saying that actually blackberries are better for your brain because they contain more antioxidants than blueberries and therefore have a stronger anti-aging capacity. Mm. And actually, I found out that amla, Indian gooseberry, is the one kind of berry with the highest antioxidant power on earth, it seems like.
Wow.
So I don't know if anybody can find it easily, that I really don't know, but it's an interesting little fact. And dark leafy greens contain a lot of vitamins and minerals and all sorts of phytonutrients that really support the immune system and help fight disease. And then I would say extra virgin olive oil has long been shown to be incredibly supportive of brain health and heart health at the same time. And what's good for the heart is also really good for the brain. And it's true. Like, it's medically true.
How big of a change do you have to make? Do those small steps as you work toward a better diet, do they make a difference? Or do you see the changes once you've really made, you know, major changes if you're eating a standard American diet now?
I think any change is beneficial. And so I find whenever we talk about diets, gradual changes are better. You can't just shock the system by going on a very extreme diet right away. The diet I suggest is not really extreme, but it does include some readjustment. Right. And that's why I included a test in the book that everybody can take. And you can find out where your diet stands on the continuum from a diet that is not very good for your brain to a diet that is really optimized for your brain. And then they have recommendations for every level. Like if you're a beginner, you need to take, you know, baby steps. You start little by little and you make changes right. that make sense and that you're comfortable with. And once you're comfortable with those changes, then you switch to the next level and you keep improving until your diet is really supportive of the health of your brain, which I think is really important as we are an aging society. And, right. you know, the same way that we would want to save for retirement and for the long term, we should also eat for retirement. I think that's a good analogy.
It's a great analogy.
Yeah, we need to invest.
Yeah. And then let's close with this. If you're older, you know, and you haven't invested like you should, is it too late? Can you start now?
Right. Yes. There's evidence then. Whenever you start is good. Like, sooner is better, but it's really never right. too late. There are studies showing how people who are middle-aged and started it and changed their diet then, like improve their diet at that point, still had a much lower risk of Alzheimer's down the line as compared to people who did not.
Right.
So it's never too late, and the sooner we start, the better.
All right. The book is called Brain Food, The Surprising Science of Eating for Cognitive Power. My guest has been renowned neuroscientist and nutritionist, Dr. Lisa Mosconi. Thank you so much, Doctor. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.